Thank you, Sandra. And yes, we have a space show starting with some music from 1959. Now, why? We will explain after playing this piece of music. Harmonica George. It's called Sputnik Music. On this evening's The Space Show, it's Happy Returns. Returns from space, that is. We look at the first return from space 60 years ago this week. And our opening music dates, as I said, from 1959, the time of we're talking about in our show tonight. And yes, Harmonica George with Sputnik Music. Today's program is called Happy Returns. So, and now we're going to be looking at a happy return that happened 60 years ago. And to set the mood for it, we'll wind the clock back a few more years than that, actually, to 1958. And this is some Minnesota rockabilly, and it's called Minus One, Blast Off. Minus five, minus four, minus three, minus two, minus one.
Mother. Sprite. And then this homo baby on a meteorite. Blind, 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 blind. The brain will never see my little baby tonight. Blind, 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 blind. Let's go, darling. You're the one. I saw the pretty face by the 10-9-8-7-5. Your home, baby, with a Christmas shot. 9-6-5-4-3-4. Now, with me and my baby, it's a heaven.
Well, they don't make songs like that anymore. The following special documentary feature is based on previously classified United States National Reconnaissance Office, Lockheed Company, and Central Intelligence Agency documents and audio recordings.
The first photo taken by a camera aboard a reconnaissance satellite. It shows Miss Schmitta Airfield in what was then the Soviet Arctic. The photo was taken on August 18, 1960, by a camera mounted on a satellite called Corona. By today's imagery standards, the photo looks fuzzy and distant. Yet it was of great value, because it was the first, one of many firsts for the Corona satellite reconnaissance program.
Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, we mark the 60th anniversary of the first two successful Corona photo reconnaissance satellite missions. Not that we knew the name Corona back in August of 1960. Instead, we heard about the Discoverer satellites. This evening, we trace the history of the covert Corona satellite project and the public Discoverer series. In the decade following the conclusion of World War II, the United States defense planners were severely hampered by the Soviet Union's Iron Curtain. This curtain stood as an almost impenetrable barrier to routine information gathering by the United States. Counteractions, such as high-flying reconnaissance aircraft and camera-carrying balloons, were attempted, but provided only a thin trickle of useful information. In 1955, President Eisenhower proposed an open skies policy in which reconnaissance aircraft would be allowed to overfly each side's territory. Soviet Party Chief Nikita Khrushchev opposed the offer. In 1958, Eisenhower set in motion a daring attempt to counter the effects of the Iron Curtain. Richard Helms was, between 1966 and 1972, the director of the United States Central Intelligence Agency. He put it this way.
For a moment, let us think back to a point in time, to October the 24th, 1957, to be precise. On that date, the President's Board of Consultants on Foreign Intelligence Activities submitted its report to President Eisenhower on the status of the intelligence community's collection capabilities. The critical need for intelligence at that point in time warranted an interim photo reconnaissance system that could get into operation earlier than the SAMOS could be ready. This was a significant decision, particularly for that era. Just 20 days before, the Soviet Union had orbited the world's first satellite, Sputnik 1, from the Churyatam range. The United States was still over 3 months away from launching its first small satellite. But the need for reliable intelligence on Soviet missile deployment was becoming more and more urgent. The so-called missile lag debate was already underway, with the Senate prepared a subcommittee holding hearings on this issue. The White House responded rapidly to the board's recommendations. Only 8 weeks after Sputnik 1, the President decided to proceed with a joint CIA Air Force interim photo reconnaissance satellite program to answer the critical intelligence questions about Soviet missiles. The system was to be based on physical recovery of film from the space vehicle. This decision marked the birth of the remarkable Corona Project. The full import of the decision, however, can be comprehended only if we recall the primitive nature of our understanding of space technology and the critical need for hard intelligence information.
And that was Helms. The Eisenhower decision was daring, both politically and technically. The United States would build and launch satellites carrying cameras that would look down on the Soviet Union.
And so we set out on December 8, 1957, to build and develop what has become known as Corona, the world's first photographic reconnaissance satellite. Its importance from today's perspective is momentous. In the weeks after Sputnik 1, there was pressure from all quarters to accelerate the U.S. missile and space program. And there was much public debate about military versus civilian control of the space program. In the perspective of that time, President Eisenhower addressed the nation.
Long-range ballistic missiles, as they exist today, do not cancel the destructive and deterrent power of our strategic air force. The Soviet launching of Earth's satellites is an achievement of the first importance, and the scientists who brought it about deserve full credit and recognition. Already, useful new facts on outer space have been produced, and more are on the way as new satellites with added instruments are launched. Earth's satellites, in themselves, have no direct present effect upon the nation's security. However, there is real military significance to these launchings, as I have previously mentioned publicly. Their current military significance lies in the advanced techniques and the competence in military technology they imply. For example, the powerful propulsion equipment necessarily used.
And that was the words there of President Eisenhower. The spy satellite attempt was given two names. To the public, it was Discoverer, a technology and scientific project. To the Air Force and the CIA, it was Corona, as in coronavirus, a series of photo-reconnaissance satellites. The idea of spy satellites had been under active study in the United States since 1946. Active planning proceeded during the early 1950s, with several electronic and photographic systems being developed. By 1954 December, industry was invited to bid on designing these satellites. In 1956 October, Lockheed Aircraft Corporation was awarded the contract to build the satellites.
The contractor chosen for the Agena subsystem was Lockheed Aircraft, which also served as the prime contractor. Lockheed had responsibility for integrating the payload, operating the launch preparation facility, and managing the subcontracts.
However, progress was delayed by funding shortages. Not everyone believed the satellites could work in the weightless and airless environment. By 1957 September, the dual identity of Discoverer and Corona had been devised to keep up the pretense that all United States satellite efforts were purely peaceful and scientific. Then, on 1957, October the 4th, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1. This shock caused funds to be released to complete development of Corona. The Corona satellites had film-based cameras. After exposure, the film was spooled into a capsule that separated from the satellite and returned to Earth. The final descent was by parachute, which could be snared by a cargo aircraft in mid-air. Because the covert nature of Corona had to be kept secret, there were many involved in the Discoverer that had no idea of its real purpose. This needs-to-know culture had its funny aspects. One highly placed Air Force officer was in the Don't Need to Know camp. Aware of the publicly announced Discoverer project, he went around convincing people they should be doing things that in fact were being done in the secret Corona project. The Corona people initially thought to stifle such assistance, but then realized this ill-timed propaganda had its useful aspect. This was because it was inconceivable that one so highly placed could be unaware of actual reconnaissance programs. So they let him rant on about what the Air Force should be doing. The recovery of the capsule could not be kept secret, so it was decided to stage a shell game that would let the real capsule vanish en route from the recovery area off Hawaii to the mainland. The first attempt to launch a Discoverer was made on January the 21st of 1959. Unfortunately, Unleashed orientation rockets on the Thorogena ignited prematurely, severely damaging the second stage.
Under the highest priorities, the preparations for test launches were completed by January 1959. However, the first vehicle aborted on the launch pad due to inadvertent firing of the separation system. Success would not come easily to Corona. The second Agena, labeled Discoverer 1, was launched on 28 February 1959 and never heard from again.
And that carried no capsule, however. Discoverer 2 was orbited on the 13th of April. This vehicle had a return capsule. Unhappily, human error in setting the satellite's timer caused the capsule to eject halfway around the Earth from the planned recovery zone. It descended near Spitsbergen, a Norwegian island in the Arctic Ocean. There were reports that the descending parachute had been observed. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Charles Matheson was not cleared to know about Corona. When he heard of the Spitsbergen sighting, he and a junior officer flew in civilian clothes by commercial airlines to Norway. With the aid of a highly placed Norwegian Air Force officer, they made a ground and air search of Spitsbergen. No sign of the capsule was found. There were rumors that the capsule had been retrieved by a resident Soviet mining party. Now, this was of no consequence as the capsule contained no film, just mechanical mice to record biomedical data. During the remainder of 1959 and early 1960, the Discoverer project suffered a series of failures.
Problem after problem plagued the early Corona launch attempts. These were truly the days of space pioneers, where the solution to last month's failure only surfaced new problems for which engineering solutions must be found, and finding them meant little time to look for optimized solutions requiring long development spans.
By August of 1960, it was decided to test Discoverer 13 without a camera system to make sure that all of the problems that caused the previous failures had been corrected.
Then, on 10 August 1960, the diagnostic Flight 13 was readied for launch. At the time Discoverer 13 was launched, a number of major problems remained to be solved. Achieving an acceptable orbit, operating the camera, and in the all-important recovering of the payload film.
In a Lockheed documentary, they gave this description of the mission.
10 August 1960. The place, Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. Time, 6 a.m. The launch crew is preparing to launch Discoverer Satellite 13 into an orbit that will carry the vehicle around the Earth over the poles every 94 minutes. The objective of this Discoverer launch is to recover an instrumented capsule ejected from the satellite following 27 hours of spaceflight. A total of 17 orbital passes around the Earth. The success of this mission is essential to our nation's long-range space programs. For the data gained on this flight will provide the basic groundwork for future flights, when it will be necessary to recover a human being from his orbiting space vehicle. As this orbital countdown progresses, a brief review of the Discoverer program events leading up to Flight 13 seems appropriate. In less than 18 months, under the direction of the Ballistic Missile Division of Air Research and Development Command, the Agena satellite vehicle has been successfully injected into orbit 10 times out of 15 launches. The Agena space vehicle, designed and developed by Lockheed Missiles and Space Division and Douglas Thor, have provided the Air Force with the most reliable booster-satellite combination yet developed in our nation's space program. The initial Agena vehicle model employed in the Discoverer program is approximately 20 feet long, 5 feet in diameter, and weighs close to a ton, minus payload and fuel. Final thrust to inject the satellite into orbit is provided by a liquid propellant engine built by Bell Aircraft. Agena, the first production line satellite vehicle, is now considered to be the space truck of many satellite programs for both the Air Force and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. This choice was made chiefly because of the high degree of reliability experienced in the 12 launches preceding Discoverer 13. The payload for Discoverer 13 is mated to the Agena satellite. Developed by the General Electric Company, the recovery package contains scientific instrumentation capable of making 145 separate measurements on the capsule's performance during all phases of the launch, orbit, and re-entry. The total weight of the payload, including the nose cone, is 349 pounds. Following mating, booster, satellite, and payload are erected. For the first time, a satellite payload is destined to be returned to its builders. The significance of this recovery event cannot be minimized, for it will rank among man's major scientific achievements.
On the 10th of August, Discoverer 13 was successfully inserted into orbit.
Stations report manned and ready for terminal count.
First stage manned and ready.
Orbital stage manned and ready. The terminal count will be by function only. Minutes announced will be approximate rather than by real time.
The launch sequence will start on my mark. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, mark.
The liftoff combination roars aloft, pitches over, and streaks downrange.
Now, we're going to pick up the story of Discoverer 13 and 14 after these messages.
From Sandringham to South Yarra, you're listening to Southern FM.
Radar tracks the vehicle as a stream of telemetry data pours into the waiting receivers. Each event occurs on sequence. The Agena separates from the booster, coasts for a few moments. Then its own engine ignites, rapidly accelerating the satellite to an orbital velocity of nearly 26,000 feet per second. Almost immediately after orbital injection, small gas reaction jets start the vehicle into a 180-degree yaw turn. The first phase of the recovery sequence. Approximately 1 hour and a half after launch, the Satellite Test Center receives word from Alaska that radar has acquired the satellite on its first pass. Discoverer 13 is on orbit, and everything is proceeding as planned.
After circling the globe 17 times, the capsule separated from Discoverer 13, retrofired, and re-entered the atmosphere some 500 kilometers northwest of Hawaii.
Now all attention shifts to Hickam Field, where the control center for the recovery operation is located. Employing data received from computer operations, the predicted impact area is located on a plot board. Out on the Hickam flight line, the aircraft comprising the aerial recovery forces are made ready. There are four RC-121 radar picket planes to monitor the descending capsule and to direct the C-119 pickup aircraft. The C-119s are equipped with aerial recovery devices to snag the parachuting capsule. In the event of failure to snatch the descending capsule in the air, there are two Pacific Missile Range Victory ships standing by in the impact area, carrying helicopters to effect a sea recovery. On the 17th pass of the satellite, the deorbiting sequence will start as the vehicle passes over the Alaskan coast. The aircraft takes station with a timing factor allowing them to complete their mission and return to base well within the margins of range and safety. Approximately 200 miles out in space, the vehicle comes over the pole on pass 17, and the capsule ejects. Retro rocket thrust sends it earthward, and soon the parachute blossoms to slow the hurtling capsule to a descent rate of 25 feet per second. The aircraft are vectored in to make the recovery attempt.
And so began a comedy of errors. Because of a confusion in communication between aircraft, the air snatch did not happen, and the capsule splashed into the Pacific Ocean.
The capsule descends just out of visual range of the nearest C-119 and impacts the water. The capsule is designed to float for sufficient time to enable a helicopter to arrive from one of the victory ships.
Within a few hours, the capsule had been retrieved from the water by a helicopter and deposited onto the deck of the ship Haiti Victory.
Sends its helicopter to the impact point as the other aircraft circle overhead. Space age history has been made.
This is the publicly announced version of what happened next, as told in this newsreel report. Ed Ehrlich, of Universal International News.
Discoverer 13 roars aloft from a California launching pad. It's Lucky 13, because after 17 orbital passes around the Earth, the missile's payload, a data capsule, is dropped to Earth and recovered 330 miles from Hawaii. The first man-made object ever recovered from outer space. Ceremonies in the White House mark the historic feat. Air Force Chief General Thomas White addresses the President.
Within this capsule, Mr. Rosen, are a great many telemetering equipments and other scientific devices. However, there is one other package, which is a national flag. This flag contains 50 stars. It is perhaps significant that this flag was released from orbit in outer space in the vicinity of our 49th state and recovered in the vicinity of the 50th state, Hawaii. On behalf of the Secretary of the Air Force, the officers, the airmen, the civilians, and our scientific and industrial team, I am proud, Mr. President, to present you this flag of the United States of America.
Thank you, Tom. It's a real present.
This fiction was maintained by the Lockheed documentary feature.
Aboard the recovery ship, the capsule is placed in a special container for eventual transport back home. The first public showing of Capsule 13 occurred during ceremonies in which the President of the United States removed an American flag from the capsule. This flight marks not only a clear first for the Air Force Lockheed team in space technology, but marks a major contribution to American international prestige.
Now, what really happened was only revealed publicly in 2010, when the National Reconnaissance Office released previously classified documents. As noted earlier, the plan had been to switch the real capsule for a dummy. The dummy would go to Lockheed's factory in California by a rather obvious route. The real capsule would be repackaged so as not to resemble the original. It would be carried in an unmarked truck from California to New York, where Kodak would develop the film. These precautions were necessary because examination of the real capsule would disclose it had a film entry aperture. Because Discoverer 13 was a diagnostic craft, it had no film aperture and carried neither camera nor film. Now, do you remember Charles Matheson of Spitsbergen fame? He, not knowing anything of these decoy plans, landed by helicopter on the flight deck of the Haiti Victory and assumed charge. He had his own plan. He told a newspaper man friend of his of the planned itinerary. He wanted to ensure good coverage in the papers and on television. Matheson believed that the Air Force was not receiving enough publicity for its space efforts. Now, with a real capsule that had actually been in space, he had precisely the wedge he needed to draw attention to the fine work being done by the Air Force. Matheson accompanied the capsule to Pearl Harbor. He arranged by radio to have the Commander Pacific Air Force meet him at the dock for a photographic opportunity. Needless to say, the commander was not in the Corona need-to-know group. Matheson transferred the capsule to a C-130 freighter aircraft and began the flight to California. While airborne, he passed the time by breaking into the capsule. He found it to be almost empty. In California, he organized another photo opportunity and allowed Lockheed technicians to remove a few items of instrumentation. The previously classified National Reconnaissance Office document at this point has three lines redacted. Presumably, these redacted lines identify Lockheed employees and what they did. On August the 13th, Matheson and the capsule landed at Andrews Air Force Base, providing another photo opportunity. Now, August 13 was a Saturday, and the capsule spent the weekend at the Pentagon. On Monday the 15th, the capsule was transported with great fanfare to the White House. With cameras rolling, President Eisenhower hailed the first ever recovery of a satellite as historic. For weeks and months, the capsule was displayed throughout the United States. It finally came to rest in the Smithsonian Institution's Air and Space Museum. The irony of this story that it was the officer who should have taken charge of the capsule, had Matheson not snatched it away, who was decorated. Colonel Lee Battle received the Legion of Merit Medal. Matheson received nothing other than having his photo in the newspaper. A Corona Project officer was later said to have stated that the only persons more confused than Matheson must have been the Soviets. Matheson had single-handedly and convincingly documented the innocent nature of the United States space capsule. Clearly it contained nothing noxious. No bomb. No camera. No leaflets, just one American flag. 3 days after the White House ceremony on August the 18th, Discoverer 14 was launched. Now, this did carry a camera and film. The capsule was successfully ejected and air snatched as it descended by parachute. The Lockheed documentary described the Discovery 14 mission thus.
8 days later, the success was repeated with Discoverer 14. All events occurred as predicted, and the aerial recovery was achieved without difficulty, demonstrating that this concept is practical. Other flights will follow with an increasing percentage of success as more complex vehicles and payloads make their bid for space conquest.
Ed Herlihy gave this description for Universal International News.
Air Force flying boxcars deploy over the Pacific Ocean, target area of the Discoverer 14 nose cone capsule, which is snared in mid-flight as it plummets to Earth from orbit. The mid-air recovery at 10,000 feet is the second recovery of a man-made object from orbit. Shortly afterwards, Russia announced the third successful re-entry of a nose cone carrying two dogs and some rats and mice. Dramatic strides by both sides in the space race give promise of major developments in man's efforts to actually send human explorers into the far reaches of the solar system. America's Man in Space and Satellite Research Programs mark continued a significant achievement, exemplified by a sky now filled with American moons.
Audiences in the British Commonwealth nations heard the news from British Pathé.
A C-119 flying boxcar heads for a dramatic rendezvous above the Pacific. The crew is hoping to make the first aerial catch of a space capsule released from a satellite in orbit. After two unsuccessful passes, the parachuting capsule is snagged on the third try. Almost like reeling in a fish, the traveler from space is pulled up to the Air Force plane. The 300-pound prize was part of the satellite Discoverer 14, which was launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. The capsule was then released on its 17th orbit around the Earth. This United States space triumph comes even as the Soviets successfully recover two living dogs from orbit. The race is hotter than ever.
This time, Matheson did not hijack the capsule and its precious cargo of film. It was quietly couriered to Eastman Kodak in New York for film processing. When they saw the photographs, CIA photo interpreters were flabbergasted.
Although the initial photography was substantially lower in resolution than that from the U-2, it was of intelligence value. This one mission yielded more photographic area coverage than the total of all U-2 missions over the Soviet Union. More importantly, the mission covered areas never previously reached, and a new age of technical intelligence had begun.
1,000 meters of film was recovered from the Discoverer 14 capsule. The images covered 422,000 square kilometers of the Soviet Union. Arthur Lundell was the director of National Photographic Interpretation Center that was charged with analysis of the photographs.
Now, little did we realize what was going to develop so quickly when on the 18th of August, in 1960, this first satellite was successfully retrieved. It flew for only one day. It had 17 passes, eight of them over the Soviet Union, and 20 pounds of film came back. And with that film in hand, we turned to, and in less than 7 days, we had produced 130 pages of text. We had a 1.5 million square miles of coverage of the Soviet Union. This was the harbinger that warned us of what was coming. And as we were steadily gearing up and trying to get ready for what was coming, both in instrumentation and procedure and data handling products, the film was flowing in.
Now, the comedy of errors continues now. After President Eisenhower saw the Discoverer 14 photographs, he wanted everything about Corona kept secret, lest Khrushchev be offended. As his comment was passed down the chain of command, his cautionary words were translated and amplified. It became, "Destroy the capsule." So the Discoverer 14 capsule was literally beaten to pieces and dumped in the Santa Barbara Channel. So perhaps it is serendipitous that Discoverer 13 is in the hands of the Smithsonian curator James David, who describes its significance.
Discoverer 13 roars aloft from a California launching pad. It's the first man-made object ever recovered from outer space.
President Eisenhower established the Corona Imagery Intelligence Satellite Program in 1958. Discover was the cover name. Discover 13 was the first success in America's first imagery intelligence satellite program. It led to many successful missions, approximately 120 over the next 12 years. It also happened to be the first object that either the United States or the Soviet Union successfully recovered from orbit. Reconnaissance from space, which included good photography of the enemy, was an absolutely critical factor in keeping the Cold War cold. The United States and USSR were photographing each other, and by the mid-1960s, America knew how many Soviet intercontinental ballistic missiles they had, what their capabilities were, and where they were located. Without timely and accurate intelligence information on the Soviet Union, we would have been acting in a vacuum. As in any crisis, when there's a lack of information, good decisions are not made. Intelligence collected by the Corona program helped prevent a nuclear war between the Soviet Union and the United States that would have devastated both countries and many other countries in the world.
The Corona program went on from the Discoverer 13 and 14 successes. In all, there were 145 launchings, returning 600 kilometers of film. The cumulative coverage was well over 2 billion square kilometers. The final Corona mission was flown in May of 1972. Now, other, more capable spy satellites took its place. Initially, they too returned film and capsules, sometimes 4 per satellite. Well, this has been our Space Show documentary feature on the Discoverer and Corona satellites and the first 2 missions to be recovered from space.